This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Inside The Briefing Room every week, we connect the experts who know what they're talking about with the subject you need to understand. And after 28 minutes, you, and me too, know something about the world that we didn't before. This week, as Britain heads for big trade talks with the EU, we take a look at the position of one of our most romanticised and politically charged industries, fishing.
With your nets and gear, we're faring.
Once hardy Britons trawled the oceans for silver darlings or took their small boats to the rough coastal waters without fear or favour. Or such is the image.
It's there on the deep that we harvest and reap.
Then, the story goes, it was taken away from us.
Our coastal communities really need the revival of their fishing industry back. The Common Fisheries Policy Got Go has been a disaster.
Wasn't it scandalous what we heard about the cod supplies? 92% of the quota not going to British fishermen, but going to continental fishermen.
We want our waters back so we can have it for ourselves, for our future.
On a sailing lugger. Or to go on the hunt the shores of heaven.
The phony war is over, and proper trade negotiations with the EU will start in a few weeks. And a possible deal-breaker, we're advised, is the fishing industry. So this week, I want to find out why, what fishing policy actually means, who it affects, and what lies ahead. Grab your sou'wester, step inside the briefing room, and together we'll find out.
Of herring.
First, I want the essential facts about what the industry looks like today. Joining me from Edinburgh is Hazel Curtis, Director of Seafish, which represents all UK fishing businesses. Hazel Curtis, how many people does the British fishing industry actually employ?
The fish catching sector employs around 12,000 or so people throughout the UK. But of course, they're very much dependent on who they're selling the fish to. So we've got to consider the fish processing sector as well, which is around another 20,000 people.
So it's about 32,000, maybe upward of that, involved in the fishing industry.
In fish catching and fish processing. And then, of course, if you go to fish and chip shops, you're off again.
And now, allowing for the fish and chip shops, who are these people and where are they?
There are lots of regional variations. In Scotland, you've got a mixture of local crew, some from other EU countries, a lot of people who came to Scotland to fish from Eastern European countries back in 2004, 2005, when we started getting people from Lithuania, Latvia and so on. But also people from further afield, from the Philippines or Sri Lanka or Ghana, who come on seafaring visas and so on. So there's people come from all over the world. In England, there are also some EU workers on fishing boats, particularly in the southwest on the bigger boats. And then the smaller vessels tend to be operated by the owners and local crew.
Let's look a bit about how the fishing industry may differ from one part of the UK to the next. How is Scotland different to England, for example?
In Scotland, There's a fleet of around 25 or so very large fishing boats that catch fish that swim in midwater, so the herring, mackerel, sardines and those kinds of fish, the oil-rich fish that are very, very good for you. Those are nearly all based in Scotland and they go quite far afield. Then you've got vessels that fish more within 200 miles or so of the UK, catching our bottom swimming whitefish species like cod and hake and so on. Most of those vessels are also in Scotland. The smaller inshore boats that maybe restrict themselves to 10 or 12 miles from the shore, there are more of those in England than there are in Scotland. And of course, we've got Wales and Northern Ireland as well.
What is the relative size of the Scottish and the non-Scottish fishing industries?
About half of the UK workers in the fishing sector are in Scotland, 40% in England and the rest in Northern Ireland and Wales. And in terms of the value and quantity of fish landed, it's more like 60 to 70% from year to year is in Scotland. There is overall more happening in Scotland in terms of quantities.
Sorry, you can say that again. From your statistics, what you just told us, Scotland is vastly more important in terms of its fishing contribution than anywhere else in the UK.
Scotland is more important to fishing, and also fishing is more important to Scotland because Scotland's economy and population is only a tenth the size of that of England. And yet it has more than half of the fishing.
How does the UK industry compare in terms of its size and profitability with, say, France?
The UK industry is, in some respects, comparable in size to the French industry. Spain has the biggest fish-catching sector in the EU. So if we look at revenues, the British fleet is around £1 billion at the moment. The Spanish fleet would be twice that. French fleet is a bit higher again than the British fleet. But in terms of profitability, the UK fleet is doing very well in terms of profit margins. We've had some very good fish sales prices. We've had, relatively speaking, lower fuel prices. So if your costs are lower and your sales prices are higher, naturally you're going to be doing better. So there's been considerable degree of optimism and investment in fish catching in amongst larger vessels in Scotland and southwest of England.
So actually we have right now, under current situation, we have a pretty profitable fishing fleet.
Overall, it's doing pretty well right now, yeah. Some of the smaller vessels are having a harder time. Some of the vessel businesses operating smaller boats and closer to shore are struggling a bit more at the moment.
What can we say about the average earnings of somebody operating a small boat?
It varies considerably. If you're a successful 12-metre vessel catching crabs and lobsters off Bridlington, they'll be doing very well for themselves. But if you're operating a smaller vessel, maybe in the English Channel, there you'll have much more restricted income.
How important is fishing overall to the UK economy?
What's evident by the amount of airtime that fishing is getting is that the true value of fishing to the UK economy comes in terms of culture and history and sense of self and our identity as a seafaring nation. It's hard to capture in monetary terms how important that is. You can see that in practice by how much political weight it carries.
No, absolutely, but it still leads me back to the question. Yeah, if we were to look at it in monetary terms, what would be the answer?
Yeah, less than 0.5% of the UK economy.
Less than 0.5% of the UK economy, and yet, as you say, has this terrific cultural and political weight. Why?
It's to do with food and territory and things that are fundamentally important to human life, human existence. There's something about our history, our sense of nation, our sense of self. There's something much deeper than finances.
Hazel Curtis. Consumers here are important. And one thing we need to understand in all this is which fish we Britons eat and which fish we export. So here's fisherman and fish writer Nick Fisher to tell us.
In Britain, there's really five fish that we buy, which is cod and haddock, tuna, prawns and salmon. They are really what we consume as a nation. The cod's mostly from Iceland and the Faroes. Haddock mostly from Norway. The prawns, well, they're coming from all over the place. A lot of those unfortunately are farmed in the Far East. So they're travelling a long way to get here. The salmon, well, obviously we are farming quite a lot of that ourselves, but a lot of it's coming over from Norway too. And then the tuna, quite a lot of it comes via Spain, but some of it will actually get air freighted in from places like America. So there's this kind of curious imbalance. 75% of the fish that we eat, we import. At the same time, the fish that we are catching, plenty of them, are fish that we don't want to eat, and therefore they're exported to mostly Spain, Italy and France, where they absolutely adore our fish. If you go and eat sardines in Portugal, there's a very good chance they've come from Cornwall. A lot of the mackerel from Scotland is exported. If you look at the south coast where I am, the brown crab, the spider crab, the velvet crab, the lobsters, turbot and brill, the high-priced prime fish, the Dover soles, nearly all of those variety of species are being sold into Europe. They are our main customers. If you compare a Spanish supermarket to an English supermarket and you look just at the fish counter, you know, they are worlds apart. In a Spanish fish counter, you will have species that you've probably never seen in Britain, like poaching, which they call faneca, which is a fish that our coastline is surrounded by, and yet nobody eats. There's calamari, there's squid, there's octopus, and these are not priced cheaply. These are expensive. Squid will cost you 16, 18, 19 euros a kilo. Nobody over here wants to pay that. If you go back to the 1800s, we ate a variety of fish. Then at the turn of the 20th century, in terms of protein in our diet, something like 16, 80% of that was from herring. The big sea change happened with the Second World War. All the fishermen are seconded to go and work for the Royal Navy. All the fishing boats are requisitioned for the Royal Navy. The fishing stops. When you come back to start fishing again, you've got, well, a fishery that's been left alone 5 years, so it's very healthy. So in the 50s and then in the early 60s, the fisheries were booming, and they were booming largely with cod and haddock. Really good, big, fat, flaky, white, muscly flesh that is absolutely delicious, particularly for fish and chips. So having come through a period of austerity, of rationing, which went on into the 50s, where people are being forced to eat weird things like snook in cans, which came from South Africa, a very oily, smelly fish that everybody hated. I think the memory of the horrible things that people had to eat during the war really put a lot of people off, for want of a better word, the kind of peasant food, you know, herrings and all that sort of thing. So everybody just ate whitefish. For me personally, I think it's just really sad that we have such a fantastic mixed fishery with so many different species in it, and yet we don't appreciate it. We're out of sync with it. Mackerel is a gift from God, and yet all of our great hand-jig squid that we catch in Britain is exported.
Nick, Fisher, and what joke could I make here that hasn't been made a million times already? So that's what the industry looks like now and who consumes its product. Now I want to know how the EU has impacted on all that. Joining me from Paris is John Litchfield, who has made the fishing industry a speciality. And with me in the studio is Dr. Jill Wakefield, an expert on the Common Fisheries Policy, or CFP, from the University of Warwick. John, how were EU quotas decided at the beginning after we had joined the European community?
I was actually there covering the negotiations in Brussels and finally in Luxembourg when it was all agreed in 1983. But essentially, the pattern that was established then remains the pattern now, which is that there would be an allowable catch. In other words, the sort of what the fishery was thought by scientists could sustain, decided every year, and that would be divided into national shares or quotas. And those quotas would be based on more or less the pattern of fisheries as it existed up till then, from the 70s up to that point in 83. The share out was obviously, you know, political in very many ways. Some of the decisions made were probably wrong. I think the Scottish fleet, as I remember at the time, was quite happy with the share out. The English fleet, much less so.
So what nations were given what and why if we dig down?
This is historic, so that the UK used to fish northern waters. It used to fish Norway and Icelandic waters. So to a degree, it advocated the waters around its coast.
So let's get this right. We actually, rather than fishing in our own waters, we'd found it better to go up and fish in Norway and Iceland.
Yeah. Since the 14th century, actually, we'd been fishing up off Iceland and Norway. And there had been successive cod wars from that period right up until the 1970s. When the UK joined the European community, to its relief, really, because it was caught up in a cod war which had attracted the opprobrium of the world. And I think it was a relief of politicians to escape into the European community so that the community could then deal with it.
John, what do you make of that?
The British fleet was actually given a bit of a bonus because one of the arguments for the British had been we lost all our fisheries off Iceland and Norway already, and therefore we need to take more out of what would have been our waters had we not had to pool them with the EU. So there was a little extra given.
What did other nations think of what they got?
It came down, as I recollection, to a battle between the British and the French, as it so often does. One of the great misunderstandings and deliberate misunderstandings that's, I think, been encouraged in this whole debate is that somehow at that time in 83, we allowed the European boats into our waters, and ever since then they've been, using Boris Johnson's phrase, pinching our fish. But no, we used to fish right up to the Icelandic coast. The French boats have been going around the west of Scotland for centuries. They once fished right into the Thames estuary, which they're not allowed to now. So these waters were not national waters.
How was it decided who got what? I mean, you get a quota for the country, but then somebody's got to do the fishing and has got to get the quota. How does that work?
Between the 70s and the 80s, really, fishing communities were in decline and the fish weren't of much interest, I suppose, to Westminster. So most of the allocation went to Scotland and the English missed out on that. But I think that they weren't interested. The government had said it wasn't going to do battles over fish. It had said it in the Cod War and it said it subsequently when there were the negotiations over the settlements for the common fisheries policy. It wasn't important enough.
We were one of the only countries in the beginning which kind of allowed people to buy quota. They could buy someone else's boat and they could not necessarily keep that boat, but they could keep the quota. That has been solidified ever since by government edict. And so now we're about the only country in the EU where you can easily own quota. And that is one of the crucial things to remember in this whole debate. Because the way the quotas were organised was that they were attached to each boat and the track record of each boat. So if you bought that boat and kept it afloat, as you can still in France, you could keep the quota with it. But in Britain, the rule was from 1999, I think, changed and made even more clearly in favour of ownership of quotas, where you could buy a boat and you could buy the quota that went with the boat and then use the quota with another boat. So the quota became a saleable commodity in itself.
I just wanted to look at the logic of this point of having a quota that you are allocated, which you're then allowed to sell. Because the thing it reminds me of is when we were supposed to become a share-owning democracy and shares in certain things were given out to a lot of people, the privatisation campaigns, what then happened was that those shares were then sold on to large organisations who bought significant amounts of them up. Is that what happened with the quota? Have people sold on their quota to bigger organisations?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very interesting analogy. I think the Danes have a system of auctioning off quotas, so there is a sense of ownership there. One or two other countries come close to it. But Britain is the only country that's gone as far as saying you could buy a boat and you could buy the quota that went with the boat and then use the quota with another boat. A large part of the Scottish quota, which is two-thirds of what we have, is concentrated in the hands of five or six very rich Scottish fishing families, you know. Now, that's because of the selling on of quota, which was kept within Scotland, but still concentrated in the hands of some very rich families and therefore taken away from the fishing policies of smaller fishermen and smaller ports.
Did you have to sell the quota to somebody who was British?
You had to sell it to a boat which was flagged as British, which was had some sort of economic connection with Britain. So now that has become even more extreme. So something like half of the English quota, not the Scottish quota, which is interesting, something like half of the overall tonnage of quotas allocated to English boats are now owned by companies which are Dutch, Icelandic and Spanish. Now, they still come into British ports a little, but the extent to which they are really economically connected with Britain is a big issue in this whole debate.
So half the English quota is not actually English fishing?
Well, you can argue that. That's nothing to do with the EU. Basically, that's something that the EU doesn't really approve of, but it hasn't ever managed to challenge.
I want to understand this as, if you like, a kind of summary. The way in which the UK government decided to allocate its quotas ended up with a significant amount of the quota being sold on effectively to foreign producers and also to a concentration of the fishing in the hands of very wealthy fish companies, mostly in Scotland.
You have 77% of the boats, admittedly small boats, with 3 or 4 or 5% of the quota, and you have 23% of the boats with 94% of the quota, if you like, which is the real cause, I think, of the decline of small fishing communities around Britain. Nothing to do with the EU. We successive governments could have handled that much more helpfully to the small fishing communities than we did.
John Litchfield. Now, let's cast ahead. How is fishing likely to fare in the upcoming negotiations? Staying with me is Dr. Jill Wakefield, and we're joined down the line by Dr. Bryce Stewart from the Department of Environment and Geography at the University of York. Bryce Stewart, as far as you can gather it, what was the hope of people who were advocating leaving the European Union to a significant extent because of their views on fishing? What were they looking for?
There's two big things that have been the sticking points. So one is the amount of other EU boats coming into British waters, sometimes fishing as close as 6 miles offshore. Also, there's this issue of quotas. So it really was perceived that back when quotas were first allocated, that the UK got a raw deal. And so the hope of a lot of Brexiteers was that there would be a redistribution of quotas much more in favour of the British fleet.
Now, broadly, from what we know about the European Union, will the things that people were hoping for from this process, will those be things, Jill Welkin, as far as you know, that the European Union will be anxious to grant?
Well, the European Union has been quite consistent and said that it wants to maintain its access to and current take from fishing waters in exchange for a trade deal. So although we could exclude them and have a no-deal situation, that would mean that we theoretically could fish our own waters, but then what would we do with the fish? Because obviously we'd need to sell it. And our main export market is Europe. And if Europe puts tariff on fish, which it will do in the event of a no deal, then we'll have tariffs which would range from 2% up to 20%. And at 20%, the industry is not viable. So that's a problem. The other problem is, of course, the small-scale fisheries. Their position probably can't improve unless the allocation of the quotas changes.
Fishing is, as we've heard, relatively unimportant economically. The figure we've been given is 0.5% of GDP. It's more important in Scotland, significantly more important in Scotland. So how hard, in your estimation, is the UK going to push actually to put fishing at the top?
You have to decide where your public interest lies. So for the British, the coastal communities have voted for Brexit with the expectation that something will be done for them. So then you make a political choice. And in that political choice, you have to say, well, where is the public interest? Is it in maintaining external relations and trade relations, or is it in supporting a domestic industry?
By the public interest, I mean, I imagine what you're talking about is other sectors of British services and industry which could be traded off against what we want in terms of fishing.
Well, yes.
Bryce Stewart.
There are a lot of other industries that would really suffer in a no-deal Brexit scenario. But at the same time, the British government, Boris Johnson himself, has really taken quite a strong line on fishing and promised that he will deliver a better deal for the fishing industry. And so I think he needs to achieve something. And so my advice to the government, if they're listening, is to look for some wins where they're most important to the UK fleet, but maybe to keep some of the other access and some of the quotas as they are for the species that are important to the European vessels.
I see. So it's to come up with essentially a new form of fisheries deal with the EU, which gives them most of what they want, but gives us some things that we want too.
Exactly. I mean, for example, there are large stocks of things like blue whiting and horse mackerel and sprats in British waters, but they're not really targeted by British boats. They are targeted by, you know, the Danes and other countries. But then we could look at some really important stocks for the British fleet. Monkfish down in the southwest and haddock in the southwest, we don't have much quota. So a bit of give and take, and that way both sides can claim victory, which is what politics is all about, really, isn't it?
Jill.
The people who would miss out on that, of course, again, the small-scale sector.
Is there anything very specifically that we can do within the context of an agreement to lever up the position of those small fishing operations?
In terms of helping the small-scale fleet, I still hold out hope that if the UK government is able to actually negotiate some extra quota for some species, that they will prioritise the small-scale fleet. They haven't committed to that, but there's a lot of people putting pressure on them.
How do you do that?
Well, basically, if they get extra quota, it's then a question of who gets it. You know, the new quota can be allocated as the government sees fit. And I would hope that they'll learn the lessons from the past and, first of all, not give it out permanently, but perhaps lease it over maybe a 5 or 10 year period so that it has certainty, but it also is flexible, and prioritise the boats that basically have the lowest environmental impact, but also the highest socio-economic benefits. And so these would be the small-scale boats that are, you know, part of coastal communities.
Couldn't we always have done that?
Well, we could, yes, absolutely, and that is a really important...
So one of the ways of dealing with the post-Brexit situation is to do the thing that we could always have done when we were in the EU. I'm not making a rhetorical point here. I'm just learning from what you're saying.
No, that's absolutely true. You know, you could say it's the law of unintended consequences paying out.
I put it to you both that if you're going to give more of something to somebody, you've got to take it away from somebody else. So who's the somebody else it gets taken away from in this country, and how are they going to react?
Well, under the scenario I'm talking about, it would be extra quota negotiated through the Brexit negotiation. So I guess it would come from some of the European fishermen. And so that's going to be difficult. But I think if it's played carefully, as I said, with a bit of give and take, it's not impossible.
Jill Wakefield.
Well, they've said that they want to maintain their take. So I don't think that you can take it away from them. What we're talking about is taking it away from our own people, from the British quota. It's that redistribution of the British quota. Could you do it?
So in other words, you think that if we want a successful negotiation around fishing, what will happen in the end is that actually we will just reallocate within our own fishing sector rather than actually have a reallocation with the Europeans?
Yes, I think so.
Are we setting ourselves up for an argument between English and non-Scottish fishing and Scottish fishing?
Yes, because their interests are quite different. And the fisheries policy is one of those devolved policies. The fisheries policy for Scotland need not be the same as that for England or Wales or Northern Ireland. So it's a matter of negotiation, and the government said that it hopes that it can have a policy which is agreed between all the countries.
Dr. Jill Wakefield with Dr. Bryce Stewart. My conclusion at the end of all that is that the combination of political sentiment, competing interests and hard-edged realities make this a very tricky problem to solve in the months ahead. Someone, somewhere, is going to lose out, but right now we don't know who. And in the meantime, eat more mackerel. My thanks to Hazel Curtis, Nick Fisher, John Litchfield, Dr. Jill Wakefield and Dr. Bryce Stewart. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirsteen Knight, Jordan Dunbar and Rosamund Jones. It was mixed by Never Miserian, and the editor was Penny Murphy. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including ones on Who Are Sinn Féin, How to Make a Trade Deal, and Climate Change and Meat. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.